Hello everyone, and welcome to the second part of a fascinating interview with IBM's Chief Software Economist, Walker Royce. My name's Neil Ward-Dutton, and I'm Research Director at MWP Advisors. Now, in the first part of our interview, Walker Royce and I explored what software econometrics is and what its practical implications are. In this second part, we're going to continue our conversation as we talk about specific software delivery metrics that are important. We're going to talk about some insights from specific customer engagements and also some practical steps that you can take to get started with this practice of software econometrics. So hello again, Walker.
Hey, nice to be back with you, Neil.
Oh, great stuff. Okay, so in the first part of our interview, we started to pick apart the impact that the practice of software econometrics could have on an organization's software delivery capability. So, you know, I think that was kind of a really nice taster and probably got a lot of people's interest piqued. But I think it would be great for us to start to dig a bit more into some of the practical details. So, I mean, I know that through the research and the engagements you've done, you've learned quite a bit about quite specific metrics that are important in terms of driving the key things we were just talking about in the first part around understanding the cost of change and linking that into really proper understanding of agility. So, you know, we're talking about econometrics as a measurement discipline for a really kind of deep improvement in productivity and hopefully sustainable improvement in productivity. So, are there specific metrics that an organization should take as kind of starters to build measurement discipline around?
Definitely. And, you know, let me describe two dimensions of metrics that we need for effective steering. The first is progress metrics, which are indicators of how much work has been accomplished. And then the second is quality metrics, which provide indications of how well that work has been accomplished. Now, with those two perspectives, you know, stakeholders can make an accurate and balanced assessment as to whether the project is likely to deliver successfully and also more predictably.
Right. Okay. So just to kind of reflect that back, essentially looking at things in terms of how much you've done and how well you've done it. So, okay.
Right.
So looking at the progress metrics you just talked about, the kind of how much metrics, which are the ones of those that are, you in your eyes, are really essential to focus on? Can you talk through those?
There's many ways to do this, but I think there's three key patterns which can be implemented in different ways in different domains, but the three kind of core patterns are pretty strong.
Okay.
So, first of all, you've got to make sure your plan or your progress metrics are measuring results rather than just activities. And consequently, you know, as I said earlier, results or where the facts are in executable demonstrations, and we want to organize these in units of user visible chunks. So let me go through three key progress metrics. The first is planning progress. And with conventional engineering governance, this was always measured through milestone achievement and earned value by producing all supporting artifacts, which were mostly documents. But in our modern best practices, planning progress we found is better measured with an anatomy of planned features or user stories, some sort of capability that can be demonstrated to the user community. So rather than laying out a big plan of here's all the work we're going to do and documents we're going to produce, you want to focus your plans on here's the sequence of demonstrations we could make to the users to show them progress and elicit a better understanding of the important uncertainties and the detailed uncertainties. So the first one is planning progress. The second one is technical progress. Now, with few exceptions, waterfall managed projects were mired in very inefficient integration and late discovery of substantial design issues. When we followed an engineering mindset for software, you tend to expend roughly 40% or more of your resource in integration and test, with most of that effort consumed in excessive scrap and rework, especially during the late stages of a project. By following a linear sequence of activities from requirements to design, code, to unit test, and then to integration, what projects effectively did is delay the tangible understanding of the really significant uncertainties, the hard parts.
Right.
So the target profile for technical progress in a more agile software delivery project is to get a sequence of progressions and digressions of executable code. So you build enough code to execute, for example, the most important use case that drives the performance of your system, and in demonstrating that, you learn what's good, what's bad, and then you go backwards as you fix the things that are wrong and refactor the architecture as needed. Now, when you do this, you're performing integration testing earlier through a progression of demonstrable releases, and the downstream scrap and rework tar pit can become avoidable, along with all the late shoehorn fixes that degrade system changeability. So planning progress and technical progress are two key ones. And again, both of these are measured in user-visible chunks, which can take on several different forms. Right. Now, the last progress metric is something we call economic progress, which is quite different from conventional techniques and really forces projects to transition to a much more honest exchange between stakeholders. And this is a measure of the uncertainty remaining. And we capture that as exhibited in the variance in the cost or time to complete estimate. Okay, so, you know, conventionally managed software projects typically experience very early optimism. They think they know exactly what their plan is and how they're going to execute. But then as they start getting into integration and test, they learn about the impacts of the really significant uncertainties they didn't solve early enough. And consequently, the uncertainty in the estimate to complete starts to diverge and get larger. So the target profile for a modern project, especially for this economic progress, is we expect the variance in the estimate to complete to start off higher. Communicate with our stakeholders, you know, why our estimate is so rough. It's rough because we don't know everything yet. Then to take on the things you don't know first, and as the project leadership prioritizes the activities and the artifacts and the demonstrations, to steer the project towards reduced uncertainty rather than just early progress, then the variance in the cost complete will reduce as well. And this is the result of much more honest communication among stakeholders in steering and managing the scope, the plans, and the solution.
Right, right. So if I tried to, you know, as you were just talking there, you know, I somewhere deep in my brain, I kept coming back to the same kind of pattern almost of behavior change that we're kind of talking about. And forgive me if I kind of misrepresent this, but it almost seems that there's a very fundamental shift in terms of behavior and attitude required here, which is it's almost kind of like a turning of everything inside out, actually, or really more, I suppose, putting it better, really thinking outside in. So whether you're talking about integration first, i.e. kind of interactions between pieces and external environments first, or whether you're talking about really thinking about external stakeholders and honest dialogue with them first, it seems that there's a kind of repeated philosophical kind of shift here, which is to think of things outside in rather than maybe the natural kind of developer's mindset, which would be more kind of inside out. Is that fair, do you think, characterization?
That's a very insightful observation. And besides just outside in, which you can think of as, you know, how is the user perceiving this, there's one other dimension that translates into, which is, you know, the conventional methods and techniques were always to do the easy parts first, to show progress against your plan and get good momentum. Whereas if you follow this behavioral pattern correctly, it's going to force you to do the hard parts first,
right,
which really, you know, scares especially the middle-level managers who want to demonstrate, you know, early progress to keep everybody bought in. And so it's very counterculture to execute properly in these new techniques, but it's important.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's great. So, you know, now just a few minutes ago, Walker, you were talking about two dimensions, progress metrics and quality metrics. And just now, I think you delved into the progress metrics very effectively. Could you sort of flip perspective and talk us through any kind of core quality metrics that you think are really important for people to think about?
Sure, and of course these are hard to do just verbally in a podcast.
Yeah,
I'll do my
best. I know.
So let's see. If you think about software, the defining characteristic of software is that it is soft. And what does that mean? That means we do things in software because we can change them. And the easier the software is to change, the easier it is to achieve any of its other required characteristics, whether it's, you know, performance, reliability, new features, et cetera. So, therefore, the most important quality metrics are centered on measurement of change trends.
Right.
So let me just discuss a few of those. I mean, first of all, you must measure defects, and changing software baselines to fix defects is certainly one dimension, and this is a dimension that's pretty well understood in the industry. Mm-hmm. And this gives you insight into the maturity and readiness for release to a user community. So, you know, measuring defects and changes caused by defects is certainly important.
Right.
The second quality metric is measuring the amount of scrap and rework. And, of course, this is key to the theories behind, you know, lean principles as well,
mm-hmm,
as agile principles. But knowing how much waste you're generating, not that the waste should be zero, but understanding where you have waste is the key to improving your processes. So the second quality metric is understanding where you have scrap and rework. And then the last one, and probably most important, is to measure the costs of change and their trends over time, which provides you insight into the effectiveness of your process and the robustness or agility of your architecture. So those are the three primary dimensions of quality metrics that I think we need to capture and implement on any project.
Okay. So, you know, as you said, Walker, you know, obviously it is kind of difficult to lay all this out in an audio-only environment because this kind of stuff really does lend itself to visual kind of exploration. But, you know, within the constraints we have, I guess you did a great job. But what would, I guess, also really help to bring this to life would be if you could talk about any sort of insights you got from any particular customer engagements you've done that kind of helped to provide a bit more color to some of these insights.
Okay. Well, first, let me before I get into some particular insights from customers, and we definitely have some. Let me expand a little on the quality metrics and some of the general patterns that tie back into the progress metrics, because I think it'll help bring them together. So in modern economic governance, you expect to discover the more expensive changes earlier. So when I discuss why we want to do integration first, it's because it'll force you to attack the malignant changes earlier, which is where the most uncertainty is. So you would hope, if you have a truly agile process and architecture, that changes get simpler and more predictable later in the life cycle, which
right.
is completely revolutionary to what industry experience is. So that's the big process change, is if you do integration activities before unit test, you actually don't do them before, they're done concurrently, but if you're focusing more on the priority of integration tests than unit tests, you will be forced to resolve the riskier architectural and design challenges prior to investing in unit test coverage and completeness type stuff. So the profiles for defect rates and maturity and scrap and rework will be very, very different.
Right.
And as the architecture is prototyped, you know, the demonstrated, tested, and refactored across all the significant usage models, these early changes will resolve the significant uncertainties and accelerate some of the stakeholder understanding of the requirements and design trade-offs.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
if you do that right, then the defect rate, you know, drops in integration testing. Your stakeholders can be much more confident that the architecture baseline is mature and that further malignant changes will be far less likely, and that most of the changes as you get into the end game will be benign. And that's the true measure of agility, namely the later you are in the life cycle, the more predictable and straightforward things are to change is really the sign of true agility. Now,
okay.
In my lifetime, I've only seen a dozen or so projects that really got that spirit of agility and demonstrated it in their results, right? And
right.
So let's talk about a couple of key customers that were able to achieve this. And I think one key discriminator is that they had an architecture and a process, and you must have both, that exhibited this, you know, discriminating characteristic that the cost of change got better over time. So we've seen a lot of people, you know, focus on their process and have a great agile process, but without a good architecture, you won't realize these benefits, and vice versa. You can have a great architecture, but if you implement the process wrong, again, you'll miss out.
Okay.
So, all right, so let me talk about a couple customers. One of these, and both of these, were very large industrial strength clients, and that's where I tend to work. I don't work in too many small projects, but
yeah.
One was a telecom system, and the other was a large command and control system built for the U.S. government. Now, the agility didn't last forever, by the way, since new technologies and markets passed them by after a decade of usage and them dominating their markets and serving their users well. So, you know, this stuff doesn't last forever, but it still creates a huge differentiator. So let me just describe a couple of discriminating patterns. There's really just two of them that I think were best exhibited by these projects, but represent the promise of what we're all trying to strive in becoming more agile, more productive. The first is that, you know, for 40 years, the industry has held an adage that, and they call it the iron law of software engineering, the later you are in the life cycle, the more expensive things are to fix.
Right. Yep.
And
yep.
My assertion is that if you're experiencing this iron law, you are probably anchored in a conventional waterfall model process with engineering management principles. And in fact, your process, you know, is probably considered pretty mature, but I would argue that it's so mature that a better word might be geriatric, because we run into a lot of processes that are very mature, and in fact, that's their problem. It's very hard to change the culture because it's so ingrained in their organization. And I think in both this telecom company and missile warning, their command and control system, you know, there was a desire among all stakeholders to be very open-minded and to take some risks and and take a win-win, you know, set of negotiated targets among all stakeholders and have the guts to follow through on them, with the promise being, you know, improved performance and better win conditions for everyone. And that's hard to find.
Right.
The second key pattern was, and result that I saw, the huge benefit, right? So the first was kind of the prerequisite you needed, getting everybody on the same page. But the second was, if you look at the real benefit of doing this, if you've really implemented the true spirit of agility, you know, you'll experience change costs with a profile that gets predictably better over time. And, you know, that means that you have real business flexibility. Now, the way you can see that is, instead of being mired, you know, especially late in a life cycle, in scrap and rework that consumes your team and keeps them playing defense almost 100% of the time, doing everything they can to try and meet whatever commitment you've made,
right,
you truly have this business flexibility and costs of change that are getting better over time, you can play offense. You can add new features. You can add more quality. You can improve performance or deliver earlier. You have the freedom to make those choices, and those results really differentiate the value from others in your market. Now, in both of the key case studies in telecom and command and control I just mentioned, the real value that I saw was how early in their life cycle, as they started getting a much more honest and better handle on their metrics and the flexibility they had, they quit treating the software development activity as a contract in which one group agreed to deliver on the specification of another group, and treated it as a shared set of objectives in which the scope changed, the plans changed, and the solution changed over time as everyone became more aware and had a better understanding of what would really satisfy the user, what it would really cost, and how it could really be achieved. And to me, that's just priceless and gives you the real business flexibility.
Yeah, yeah. But that's pretty fundamental stuff. And it's interesting that you know, you talk about those examples and the kind of things you're talking about, you know, telecom systems, command and control systems, they're kind of critical systems. This is not people messing about. You know, this
absolutely.
The stuff they're building is absolutely
high stakes products.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, very, very interesting. So, you know, clearly it sounds like cultural change is very deep component of what we're talking about here, as well as some, you know, obviously some kind of more process-related change or kind of, you know, kind of technical change around thinking about how process fits with architecture and so on. So, you know, there's a lot of different angles to the kind of journeys that people are going to have to take if they're going to take advantage of some of these insights and some of the benefits that are possible. So, you know, how would you advocate that an organization who maybe isn't particularly close to this ideal today, how would you recommend that they might start to make the first steps?
Well, there's a few very critical kind of prerequisite things that we advise a lot of our clients to start with. And, you know, the first is, I think, winning over the hearts and minds of executives and developers in these cultural transformations is really pretty easy. The harder part is winning over the middle-level managers, the project managers, the architects, the folks who, you know, have to translate technical results into business results. Their job is the hardest, and they have to take on the most risk. So, you know, starting off by training your middle-level managers and building the championship for your change initiative in the middle of your organization, I think, is critical. And to some degree, you know, the thought leaders in our industry have the easier job. It's pretty easy to identify what we should do. The harder
right.
job is doing it. you know, for me, that comes home in spades when I just think of how easy it was for me to write a book on software project management compared to how damn hard it is to manage a project. And today, I think you've probably seen more books on agile methods than you've seen successful projects with well-documented measurements on how agile the outcomes were. Just think about that. So I think, you know, we need to glorify the practice leaders in our industry, those middle-level managers and architects who translate, you know, some vision into to real execution. A couple other things you can start with, you know, piloting these techniques. Everybody wants to start pilots, you know, to demonstrate that these new methods, new tools, new techniques will work. And that's good advice, but I think you need to pilot them on things that are critical to the business, right? You don't want to run a pilot on some back office project. You want to run a pilot on a business critical project and bite off just enough that you can, you know, show that the change works under game conditions. And the main reason you want to do that is that's where your A players are. In any organization, the A players are not on the back office pilots. They're out on the front line, most critical things to the business. So that's
right.
To me, the best place where you can do change. And then finally, I think, you know, all organizations need to build a foundation for measurement, and that was sort of the subject of this talk. You know, measured improvement is the foundation of agility. You've got to have a framework for objective decision making. And hopefully the six metrics, core metrics I explained, you know, provide a starting point there. And, you know, literally, agility means quick to react. And in our world, that means, you know, software change must not be an anchor, but rather an asset. So, you think of these measures that I went through, they're all around measuring the cost of change over time and planning things around that. It's not a very difficult concept. So building a measurement practice, a measurement discipline around managing change and measuring change, I think, is a key area to start.
Okay. That's fantastic. So, I think you've actually very neatly kind of wrapped up the whole conversation there, and certainly, you know, I found it very, very interesting hearing more about what you've been doing and where you're going with this. You know, in the spirit of time, I know that we've had a pretty extensive conversation here. I think we probably need to wrap up now. So, with that, I'd really like to thank you, Walker, IBM's Chief Software Economist, for a really great discussion. In this pair of podcast episodes, we've been talking about the practice of software econometrics and how it can help transform your software delivery capability, reducing cost and risk, and improving quality. Now, if you'd like to find out more about the practice of software econometrics, or would like to find out about how you could maybe contribute towards broadening out the industry's base of data about software delivery projects, I mean, I know that's something that Walker and the guys at IBM are very keen to do, is to try and broaden the pool of knowledge that we can all kind of use to learn about how to do things better. Then the key thing you need to do is reach out to Rachel Kuta, and you can contact her on an email address I'm just about to give you. The email address is rmkuta, which is rmkuta@us.ibm.com, and Rachel will be happy to provide you further information with how you can get involved or how you can learn more about Walker's work and the practice of software econometrics. And with that, I'd like to thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed it.